So welcome to this session. This session brings together two topics which are very close to my heart, my favourites. It's annuities and IFRS 4 Phase 2. Obviously the annuities part has become very topical this week, what with the enshrining into law of the sustainability objective for superannuation. Perhaps something to be expected after the FSI though. Now I want to give you introductions to your two speakers today. So we have Martin up first. Martin's a director with Deloitte Actuaries and Consultants, specialises in the life insurance space. 22 years of experience working in Australia and Asia. And he's been a CFO and also a chief actuary for several life insurance companies in Asia. He's also a key member of Deloitte's IFRS 4 team. Cornelius and I are linked through LinkedIn. It turns out it is a small world in the actuarial profession, after all. We know some people together. We've both come over. Cornelius has come over to Australia at the end of last year, in August. Prior to that, he has been working in Deloitte in the Netherlands. Cornelius has a focus on the development and validation, the development and validation of quantitative models, actuarial reporting, and capital calculations. Now, without much further ado, I'll hand you over to Martin to begin.
Oh, thanks, Kenneth. So in this session, we would like to cover annuities, what is the future market potential, and the consequences of reporting under IFRS 4 Phase 2. Given that this is one of the last sessions of the forum, some of the issues or discussions will be covered already, so hopefully there's enough there as well that's different in this session. We will also discuss the biggest impact for annuities under the IFRS 4 Phase 2 reporting. And we also have an example in the appendix of this presentation, which, given the time constraint, we will not be able to present, but happy to go through that example with if you would like to talk about it after the session. So as most of you know, Australian superannuation system is one of the most successful in the world. And currently there are assets of about $2 trillion as of 2015. This has been projected to grow to $9.5 trillion by 2035. Most of these assets are currently in what has been termed in the accumulation phase. However, there's currently slightly less than half a trillion in what we call post-retirement phase. And it's estimated about $73 billion of these accumulation assets will move to the retirement phase in the year ending 30th of June 2017. And that's as a result of more and more baby boomers reaching the retirement age. Over the next 20 years, Deloitte has done some projections as part of its annual Super Dynamics publication that shows that the number of Australians over 65 will increase by 75%. And what this means is that assets in the post-retirement phase will grow from less than half a trillion to more than $1.5 trillion. So obviously this is a lot of assets to be managed. And so one of the key issues will be more and more people in the post-retirement age is that there's a chance that they'll live beyond their life expectancy and they don't have enough income to fund for their retirement at their desired living standard. So this is what we call the longevity risk that most retirees are currently facing with account-based pension. So if we take, for example, someone that's currently aged 65, based on the 2001 to 2013 life tables, they have a life expectancy of 85 years of age. Then therefore there's a 50% chance that they'll survive to that age. But however, there's also at least a 10% chance that they will live to at least 94 years of age. And therefore, if they're spending too much now, then they will, may not have enough money to fund their income at this age. So this is an issue that's being increasingly recognized, and there's been calls in the media. For example, in the Financial Review in January this year, that there needs to be new tax incentives for to encourage retirees to invest in annuities other than and other retirement income products, rather than some of these assets being hoarded in superannuation savings and passed on to the next generation. Also, more than 60% of advisors in March has reported that they will intend to recommend to their clients to buy annuity products, and this is a significant increase from last year of 41%. So why has annuity type products currently only represent a small market share in Australia? This is being termed the Australian annuity puzzle. So there are four key reasons. Firstly, there's the lack of consumer awareness. That's because annuities are not sold as insurance, but more as an investment product, which does not compare as well. There's been a lack of incentives and compulsion as well for annuities, both for retirees to purchase and also advisors to sell as well. There's been legislative and political barriers, which inhibits product innovation. And there are also behavioural factors, which gives a perception that annuities are expensive, as because people fear that they might die too early and not benefit from the annuity, so they live too long, not long enough to get back their investments. And so these are what's been inhibiting some of the growth in annuities in Australia. However, we see that this is changing as the longevity issues are being recognised, as more legislative and political barriers are being taken down and more incentives are provided and put in place to encourage the purchase of annuities. So hopefully this will increase consumer awareness, which then hopefully will also affect some of the behavioural factors and will hopefully lead to a growth in annuities market in Australia. So one of the positive news from the latest budget is that there's been some changes put in place that from 1st of July 2017, there's a tax exemption on earnings in the retirement phase that will be extended to products such as deferred life annuities and group annuitisation products. So we think that this will lead to financial services organisations looking to develop more products to take advantage of these incentives. So what is the way forward? Is some form of some deferred annuity the answer? I think that's the answer that's being touting around currently. This seems to make sense because deferred annuity is cost effective and also helps to manage the longevity risk because the incomes are deferred to a later age. However, we don't see that this is a one product fits all solution for Australian retirement income policy. And we support the Institute's stance on this by the recommendation that there needs to be a more comprehensive framework to manage all the issues regarding an ageing population. So, for example, issues around funding and using the retirees' home, releasing equity in their current home is one potential option as well. Also, creating an open data regime to allow access to data to allow more modelling to better manage the risk of the financial system, which is another area that needs to be looked at. And last but not least, the organisation needs to start looking at developing products around retirement income as a default option so as to start the process rolling for retirement income products. So in summary, we see increasing momentum that points to the further development in this area around annuities, and I think there will be likely to be greater growth in annuity products going forward. So now hand on to Cornelius, who will talk about the impact under IFRS 4 Phase 2.
So thank you, Martin. I think Martin explained well that there is a lot of potential for annuities in Australia. It was also touched upon in other sessions earlier today and yesterday. So that would probably mean that some insurers are thinking of developing new annuity-type products. And one of the things that should take into account is what would it mean under IFRS 4 Phase 2, so what are the elements of the new accounting standards would mean for annuity type products, and that's something I'm going to discuss today. The first slide, it's showing the timeline. It dates back to all the way to 2010, when the first exposure draft for IFRS 4 was released. In 2013, there was a revised exposure draft. Since then, the industry has been providing feedback. Also, the Australian Accounting Board has been providing feedback. And a lot of tentative decisions have been made. Those deliberations were finished earlier this year, and I do expect that the final standard is released by the end of this year, so there's no hiding anymore. It will come to Australia and the rest of the world. The effective date will probably be 2020, but it might be slightly later. At the same time, IFRS 9 has been developed, the accounting standard for investment contracts. The final standard was released in 2014, and it will become effective by January 2018. So that raised some accounting issues for companies that have both investment contracts and insurance contracts. And on that particular issue, they've written a whole new exposure draft. The two ways to cope with that. The first one is the deferral method. So insurance companies can defer the implementation of IFRS 9 until IFRS 4 Phase 2 is implemented. But in order to do that, you need to pass the predominance test. So that means that 75% of your insurance of your liability should be insurance contracts. Larger bank insurers would not pass that predominance test. For that, they have a different alternative method, which is the overlay method. And that means you will be implementing IFRS 9 with adjusted P&L items and adjusted balance sheet items. So to go back behind the reason why they developed this whole new accounting standard, basically three main reasons. One of them is uniformity. They want to be able to compare balance sheets of insurance companies all over the world. So an investor should be able to compare the P&L of an Asian insurer with the P&L of an Australian insurer. And currently that's pretty hard because they have completely different calculation methods to come up with the policy liabilities. And that will change when the whole world adopt the same accounting standard. Another one is consistency. So they want to have insurers to use updated best estimate assumptions to come up for the cash flows. Also use a discount rate that reflects the risk that is inherent in the portfolio. I think on those two things, there's not that much work in Australia because under the MOS regime, that is already being done at the moment. Another one is greater transparency. They want to provide a lot more information to the investors in the financial statements about the risk in the portfolio, about the profit sources, about methodologies to come up with discount rates, sensitivities, and so forth. And that will have a big impact on Australia because there's a lot more required than under MOS at the moment. And also the level of aggregation at which you disclose this information, that could be on a lower level of aggregation, so I need to do disclosures for more product groups. So this slide shows the comparison between the MOS liabilities and the IFRS 4 Phase 2 liabilities. Someone asked me what the shape of the best estimate liabilities, whether it was on purpose that it has the same size for IFRS 4 and MOS. So the answer is yes, because I think the cash flows will be the same, maybe some slight differences, but all in all they will be the same. The discount rate that you use, you could use the same discount rate because it's more principle-based guidance they're giving to come up with the discount rate. And within that guidance, you can still use the same discount rate you're using at the moment. It doesn't mean that every insurance company has the same discount rate because that's not the case at the moment as well. Another change is that the present value of future profits will be split up in two elements. One of them is the risk adjustment that will take into account the uncertainty of the cash flows in the best estimate liabilities. So an investor wants to know whether future cash flows are very certain, so then there's no risk inherent in them. But if there's a large amount of uncertainty, this risk adjustment will be higher, and that will provide information to the investors, to the riskiness of the portfolio. The remaining unearned profit in the contract that's reflected by the contractual service margin, it's a similar profit, concept as the PVFP, but it's slightly smaller because you have the risk adjustment as well. So as a consequence, the profitability test might be slightly different as well, because you're not taking only into account the best estimate liability. So if the PVFP is less than zero at the moment, then you have an unprofitable contract and you need to recognize that loss at day one. While under IFRS 4, you will also take into account the risk adjustment. So if the contractual service margin is lower than zero, then you have an onerous contract. So you have more unprofitable contracts under IFRS 4. And more importantly, the grouping of contracts at which you perform this profitability test might be different, because the guidance is that the groups at which you calculate this onerous contracts test should be done for groups of contracts that have similar profitability. So if we talk about annuities, in Europe, we have sex-neutral pricing, and that would mean that in Europe you would have to split up an annuity portfolio for males and females because they have different profitability. So we don't have that in Australia. But if you think of it, if you have different pricing across different age bands, that could already mean that you have to split your portfolio for each age band to do this profitability test. And also for recalculating your contractual service margin in future periods of time. Well, there's a lot of interpretation here. The IASB is still working on more illustrative examples to be added during the drafting of the final standard, but those will be non-binding. So it all comes down to what the accountant is finding acceptable. I think insurers will be seeking to have the groups as large as possible, because you don't want to end up with some smaller groups that are not profitable and other groups that are profitable. You rather combine them and have one profitable product group. But yeah, there's still some uncertainty around it, to what extent this grouping is going to look like. So on this slide, I've shown the cash flows of my annuity type example, which is in the appendix. We're not going to discuss the whole example, but I do want to show the cash flows. It is an immediate annuity, temporary, 7 years. And the general model on the IFRS 4 Phase 2 is called the building block approach. Building block 1 and 2 is basically your best estimate liabilities. Building block 3 is the risk adjustment. And building block 4 is the contractual service margin. And if we look on the left-hand side of this slide, you will see the building block 1, which are the cash flows. Premium income is in cash inflow, and the costs and the annuity outgo are the cash outflows. The DAC will be deferrable under IFRS 4 Phase 2 for annuities. That is because the contract boundary is equal to the coverage period, which is the 7-year period in this case. However, for yearly renewable business, the coverage period will be 1 year, because IFRS 4 will consider the moment that you will be able to reassess the risk in the contract and reprice accordingly as the contract boundary. And that will mean that for those kind of contracts, you will not be allowed to defer the DAC anymore. So listening to the presentation of this morning, some investors will be delighted with that, for the yearly renewable business, because they thought it was hard to understand. However, for annuities, it will be still in place. So going back to the building block approach, building block 1 is basically adding up all cash flows. Then building block 2 is the time value of money, so that's discounting back those cash flows. Building block 3 is adding the risk adjustment. And if there's profitability in this group of contracts, then you can establish your contractual service margin. If the contractual service margin is negative, then you have a lot. You have an onerous contract, and you should recognize that contract at day one. So the last slide showed the measurement and deception at day one. This slide discusses what happens if assumption changes over time and actuals are different from what you've expected. If the actual cash flow is different from the expected cash flow, the difference you would take it through your P&L, which is the same as on the MOS. If you change your best estimate assumptions for future periods of time, so for future cash flows, those will be unlocking the contractual service margin. So you would need to recalculate your contractual service margin. And the same holds for the recalculation of the risk adjustment. If there's a favorable change, so you end up with more profit in the contracts as a result of these new assumptions, there's no limit on the CSM. However, if you have unfavorable changes, there is a limit because the CSM cannot be negative. And if the remaining part should take as a loss through P&L. This also means that for each of these group of contracts, for let's say the different age bands that have different profitability, you should keep tracking your systems which loss you've taken at each point in time. And then it could be the case that you have favorable changes in your assumptions again, and you need to reestablish your CSM, that you need to book that loss as a profit first for that particular group of contracts. And then the remaining part you can reestablish your CSM with. So that can be burdensome for the things you need to do with your systems. And this might have impact. Another thing that has big impact is the discount rate you use for the unwinding, so for the accretion of interest rate on your contractual service margin. The IASB has decided that you should use the locked-in discount rate at inception. So the discount rate you're using at day one for each group of contracts, that is the discount rate you need to use for the unwinding of the discount rate at each future period in time. So that's completely different from what we're doing in Australia at the moment, because we're using the current discount rate at each point in time for the unwinding of the discount rate. The reason why they decided to do this was they don't consider the market risk as part of the service that is provided to the policyholder of a non-participating contract. And that's the rationale behind it. There was a lot of discussion around this. The Australian Accounting Board had objected against this decision multiple times. I even believe so they're going to do it another time during this drafting process. Because basically this means that you have to calculate two balance sheets at each point in time. One for calculating the unwinding of the discount rate. The other balance sheet will be the real one based on the current discount rate. And you need that one to calculate the difference between the current discount rate and the locked-in discount rate. And that difference, you can either book it in P&L or in the other comprehensive income. That is an accountancy policy choice for each insurer. It may depend on how you account for your assets under IFRS 9. If you account for them through fair value through P&L or fair value through OCI, that might influence that decision. And you're not allowed to change that decision every year, so once you make a decision, you should stick with it, unless you have very, very, very good reasons, which you can explain to the accountant. So to sum up, this slide is showing the biggest impacts for annuities. Most importantly, it's the product grouping. There may be smaller grouping required compared to the EPRA RPGs that we know. In particular, the requirement of similar expected profitability impacts this, and we're all waiting on the examples that will be released later this year. Profitability might be different. So not only the onerous contract test is different because you have more unprofitable contracts because of the addition of the risk adjustment. Also, the release of profit through time might be different. So under MOS, you would use profit carrier, probably expected claims for annuities. Under IFRS 4 Phase 2, you can choose your own run-off driver, but it should reflect the number of contracts in force. So for annuities, it doesn't have that much impact. because the annuity outgo is one-on-one related with the number of contracts. Unless there's indexation, there might be a slight difference. Another thing is the PVFP is split up in both a CSM and a risk adjustment, and also the risk adjustment is released through time. And that should be in line with the risk that is released over time, and that is not necessarily exactly the same as the PVFP released through time. But there's not a big impact for annuities. The risk adjustment, that's completely new for life insurers. The GI insurers already use calculate the confidence interval outcome on the 75 percentile. The method you use to calculate this risk adjustment does not necessarily have to be this confidence interval. You can also use a cost of capital approach, which we know from Solvency II in Europe, or another approach. It does needs to be in line with the company's risk aversion and also the diversification within the whole entity. So also banking entities for a bank insurer should be taken into account for the diversification. So that makes it very complex to come up with this risk adjustment. And also for GI, we're used to the 75th percentile. That's no longer a requirement because it should be aligned with the risk aversion. So it's the percentile is not prescribed. The last area of impact would be all the additional disclosures, in particular the locked-in discount rate, so the difference between the current discount rate and the locked-in discount rate. That will have massive impact. Also, you're required to show your profit sources in your underwriting result. So what is your result on mortality? What is your result on expenses? All those type of things. All your methodologies to come up with the risk adjustment or the discount rate should be disclosed, and also some sensitivities. So I think there's some work to be done in that area. Should this all withhold developing a new annuity product right now because you want to wait for the standard to be effective? I don't think so. I think you can already start with that if you want to do that. However, it might be useful to already store some space in your systems for the locked-in discount rate and for the losses you need to keep track of for all the product grouping. Also, in your cash flow projections, you might already want to build in some metrics that you need for IFRS 4 Phase 2, so you don't have to redevelop it when the standard becomes effective. That's basically the main message. I think that's it from our side for now. Are there any questions?
Okay, thank you both. Can we please first start by having a round of applause for that talk? So I think that was very interesting, a good market overview followed by some technical comment. We're going to have questions now. I think everybody now knows the drill here. We're going to use a mic in the centre of the stage. When you have a question, please start by saying your name and your company as well. Okay, if there's no questions to begin with, I'll kick us off, if that's okay. I'd actually a two-part question, perhaps one of the first parts for Martin, the second part for Cornelis maybe. The first part of the question was, how do you sell someone this type of income stream when they might never receive it? Are customers open to buying deferred annuities? Or what developments might have to take place for that to become the case? Regulatory, tax, and so forth, or are we there yet? And the other part was, well, how key is the illiquidity premium in terms of pricing these products, and how does that look under IFRS Phase 2?
In terms of the deferred annuities, obviously this is something that will become increasingly important as a product for retirees. Obviously, the key issue here is influencing or I guess educating the public about the issue of longevity risk that they're actually likely to outlive the life expectancy, as we show that there's actually a high chance that they can live beyond 85 years or so, when they're, if they're 65 now. And so I guess highlighting that risk to them and the chance that they might not have enough income beyond that point to fund for the desired living is key to that education process. So I guess, as I mentioned, over time, when these sort of concepts is becomes more prevalent, then that will drive behaviour and product solutions to help with that. But currently, I think unless there's more incentives and I suppose encouragement from the advisors and so on for this sort of type of products, then yes, I think this will be a area that will continue to develop. In terms of liquidity.
So a NIRF is for phase two. There's no prescribed discount rate to use, like there would be on the Solvency II, for instance. It's more principle-based guidance, so the accountant needs to agree with the insurer on whether the illiquidity premium is appropriate or not, which is already done on the MOS at the moment. So I think that you're still allowed to use the same discount rate because the accountant already agrees with it at the moment and there's similar kind of guidance. So yeah, I think there's no reason to change the discount rate for product groups under IFRS 4.
Diane Somerville from Deloitte. So I'm tackling this from a super perspective, but I guess thinking about with the current low interest rate environment and still talk of interest rates lowering, I'm interested, yes, we've got some proposed budget changes, but will we see innovation in annuities that would actually make it cost effective for retirees to purchase? And I guess also with the changes to IFRS 4, does that change the types of annuities that are going to be attractive to insurers? For example, deferred variable annuities or whatever else that could possibly be?
Yeah, I don't think the low interest rate environment should be a barrier. I suppose there's plenty of other places in the world that has low interest rates, and there is also annuity products there. But I guess it just needs to have more incentive from the government and so on to help with the development of these sort of products. I think it's the recognition, the need to annuitize for retirees to have a annuity income stream that is guaranteed of some sort. I think that's the concept that needs to be increasingly accepted. And I suppose, as I mentioned, it's not a one product fits all. There needs to be other areas such as social security, unlocking the equity within the home that will help to complement the annuity solution as well. So it's a number of factors that will help with that. And obviously, hopefully we don't see the need for the government to go to a compulsion sort of solution, but and I suppose from a UK perspective, I think we were just having a conversation with Kenneth that that's been removed, but initially there seemed to be a drop in annuity sales back in the UK, but we've since seen a gradual increase back to previous sort of volumes as well. So I think it's the recognition of the need for annuities and I guess a regular income stream is the key to the future development of annuities. Yeah
maybe a multi-premium deferred annuity might also put some relief on the low interest rate if you have premiums in the future which are based on the interest rates of the future periods, there might be a slightly relief in the perspective. And under IFRS 4, phase 2, I don't think, besides the areas I already mentioned, that there are other areas that might prevent developing the deferred annuity.
Yeah, I think it is turned off. Yeah. You could.
Still off. Well, there we go. Don Johnston, Deloitte. Can you tell us a bit about the asset risk? Okay, is there a really available set of assets that match the deferred annuity cash flows, and does that have any implication on the discount rate that you can use?
Yes, that's always a tricky one, and I guess this is where there may be a number of assets, that solutions that you may need to come up with over time, as I guess the support for these sort of type of products increases. And so currently, I guess it will be tricky with a number of fixed interest and other type of growth assets type basis, with which is linked to inflation, to support such a product. But yes, I think there needs to be more development in this space for the assets to develop to support such a product. Sorry, does that answer your question, or is that?
A discount rate. Well, I don't think there's a perfect instrument that you know, that matches the deferred annuity payments at the moment. So there's no asset return that you could directly use. You might have some combination of, well, maybe some serial coupon bonds, and use those yields to come up with a discount rate. But yeah, there's no one instrument that perfectly mimics those deferred annuity payouts.
Chris Seddon at CBA. You referred to the discount rate being locked in at day one, and that's the one that's being used to unlock in future. What happens to your existing book when we move over?
That's a good question. So for transition, in the ideal world, you would have a full retrospective application. So for each old of these small groups of contracts, you need to track back what the locked-in discount rate was at inception. However, that is a very difficult task. And you're also allowed to do a more simplified approach, where you're going to make assumptions about this discount rate at inception. But you do have to make assumptions for it, and then use that as it was the locked-in discount rate at inception.
Okay.
So it is retrospective, yeah.
Hi, Shazad from Macquarie. Just a couple of questions. There was some discussion around there's a lot of freedom in certain things. Could we expect the local regulators to provide more guidance in industry-discussed approaches, such as the illiquidity premium is right now, there's the guidance note around that. So can we expect a bit more level playing field between the local insurers? And the other question is, the way we recognize profit right now, it seems like there's a movement between the PVFP, between two different buckets, and it seems like if you move with below the onerous amount because of the risk-adjusted margin, perhaps the existing book could be seen under what we call loss recognition now. So is there guidance around how is that meant to be applied as well?
To start with the second one, yeah, there is guidance. If it's below the onerous contract line, you should recognize the loss. So there's no uncertainty around that. Regarding the guidance for the illiquidity premium, I'm not sure. I think they can give some guidance, but in the end, it's the decision of the accountant that needs to sign off on it. So he needs to agree on whether it's appropriate or not, and it also depends on each portfolio of contracts which illiquidity premium might be appropriate. So I can imagine there will be some further guidance, but in the end, it's the accountant that's signing off.
Just to add to that, there's currently an accounting and actuaries liaison committee that is working through some of this issue that you mentioned. So liaising closely with the AASB as well as the IASB as well. So these issues around risk adjustments, accretion of interest rate and so on are currently being debated. And there's some, as Cornelius mentioned, that there's some hope that they could influence the IASB to change some of the requirements for lock-in assumptions, but I think this is pretty much locked down. But it's how we actually deal with these issues now that they're pretty much close to standard that we expect to come out later this year or early next year. So I think it's just working through this issue with the accounting group as well, so that we'll get more clarity. But I think you're right. I think with the current portfolio, given the thin margins on some of the annuity books, once you put in the risk adjustments, a fair bit, quite a number of the existing portfolio will be become onerous contracts, I think.
We did sort of cover this already slightly, so I'm just elaborating on it, I think. In the UK, we did move from, or they did, should I say, move to something much more flexible where the responsibility sits with the customer. I feel there's something of a trend in Australia where some of that is becoming more of a move towards guarantees that the customer has and potentially less flexibility, but nothing close to compulsorisation yet. And so, in fact, the UK started talking a lot about measuring retirement income in terms of Lamborghinis you could buy with your pension pot. The conversation got a little bit unusual, actually. But since then, providers have been thinking about what new products they can bring to market inside this new concept of flexibility and responsibility on behalf of the customers. Deferred annuities have been muted, but they've not really taken off yet. I'm just curious, and it's maybe more of a comment than a question, but I think it's possible that as both markets develop in this area, we can probably learn from each other. Sorry, question.
David Rush, this is more of a comment rather than a question, just to let people know. There are two issues which the AASB is really hot under the collar about at the moment. One is the issue of granularity, or what the actual grouping is, which you mentioned in your presentation. You're right, that the current ISB approach is that they want things more granular. Particularly, they want loss-recognised business to be separated so that you can actually recognise the loss on that business. The trouble is that you need to group business by profitability, but you can't work out the profit on that business until you work out the grouping. So it's kind of like you're going around in a circle. So that's the first issue. The second issue is this issue about the locked-in discount rate on the CSM. Everything else accretes interest at the current rate. The cash flows, the risk margin, everything accretes interest at the current rates except the CSM. And in fact, when you recalculate, when you remeasure assumption changes, you do the calculation on the CSM at the locked-in rate, but you actually do an offsetting calculation for the assumption change on the value of the cash flows at the current rate, and the two won't match. And that little bit of difference, well, nobody else is worried about it because you can hide that difference in other comprehensive income, which other insurers around the world are likely to use. But in Australia, we probably won't. So it becomes obvious, what the hell do you do with this small difference? So those are the two issues that the AASB is hot on the collar about. And what I'd say to the people in this room, anything you can do to make people more aware of these two issues would be appreciated. Because, as I said, possibly people overseas are interested about the granularity issue, but nobody realises or recognises the problems that the locked-in discount rate on CSM might do. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yes, thanks, David, for your comments. And just to add to that as well is how granular do you go? Because at a certain level, you need to have a pooling of risks for life insurance concept to really hold. I mean, that's basically the underlying basis for insurance. There's some sort of pooling of risks. And so, do we go down to a policy, individual policy level basis to assess losses and so on? It's currently being debated. That's right. So.
Okay, I think on that last call for action, we're at the end, so we'll thank Martin and Cornelis again.